From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the program, Milwaukee gets ready to rededicate the city's statue that honors Douglas MacArthur. Plus, on its 70th anniversary, historical lessons from D-Day. We'll visit a D-Day exhibit at the Chudnow Museum of yesteryear.
Mr. Chudnow was a veteran of World War II. He landed on Omaha Beach, so we felt it was a way to honor his service during World War II and to show the great sacrifices that went on in that era.
Our sports contributor reviews the recent Milwaukee visit from the Bucks' new owners.
They seemed very, very comfortable, not just with Milwaukee and Milwaukee fans, but with selling their vision of the Bucks to those people.
And we'll have a summer drinking guide to Milwaukee. Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in. Today is the anniversary of D-Day. By this time, 70 years ago, the massive military invasion known as Operation Overlord was well underway on the beaches of Normandy. The 24,000 troops from the United States, Great Britain, and Canada paved the way for the emancipation of occupied France and ultimately the end of the European conflict. This year is also the 50th anniversary of the death of another World War II icon with strong ties to Milwaukee. General Douglas MacArthur spent much of his early life here, graduating from West Division High School. Tomorrow morning, a rededication ceremony will mark the moving of the city's Douglas MacArthur statue to its new home near the War Memorial. Chaz Mulcahy is past chairman of the Milwaukee County War Memorial and is the organizer of this MacArthur Week, as well as the first one, which was held in 1979. Deanna Alexander is a Milwaukee County supervisor who will speak at the event, and David Black is a special guest. He's from Perth, Australia, and was a child when MacArthur came to that country to help defend it from Japan. Mulcahy starts off by telling us more about MacArthur's ties to Milwaukee.
After he left Korea on April 27th, 1951, General MacArthur was awarded an honorary Doctor of Laws degree from Marquette University Law School from Father Edward O'Donnell at the old Marquette football stadium before 20,000 people. There wasn't a seat open in the place. In 1964, General MacArthur passed away on April 5th. His widow, Jean MacArthur, carried on his legacy and returned to Milwaukee in 1979 for what was then the first MacArthur Memorial Week.
Yeah, and that was 35 years
that
ago,
and here we are. And I was co-chairman, and I'm still alive. Yeah, it's good. Nice to be here.
And to see that sweep of history in that way, too. Deanna, I know you're going to be giving a talk on Jean, and she's so important to this story, isn't she?
She was his base of support. I'll be giving a speech this Saturday at the War Memorial at 8 a.m., focusing on Jean MacArthur and why she was special, unique, and courageous. And a lot of it goes back to the fact that she was a true symbol of servant leadership. She really believed in uplifting others and enriching other people's lives, and she did that directly for her husband as a way to help him do his job for the public better. A lot of people don't know that Ronald Reagan actually awarded her the Medal of Freedom in 1988. And for those who don't know, that's the highest civilian award that a person can receive for patriotic service to their country. So Jean MacArthur is a very important part of the story, and I'm really hoping to help the people of Milwaukee learn a lot more about her and the legacy that she left.
Getting back to General MacArthur himself, what makes him such a compelling figure, do you think? David Black, I want to bring you into this conversation. What is it about him that still interests us all these years later?
Well, of course, I have a very special interest and a very special relationship to this question, because the part of General MacArthur's life that I am most concerned with is a relatively short period of life, but in my opinion, of great, great importance. Between March in 1942 and September in 1944, he lived in Australia. And it's not saying too much to suggest that as far as Australians are concerned, he was their savior. He was there to save them from the Japanese. And the strong feeling that developed during that period of time was handled very effectively because of his relationship with the Prime Minister of the day, John Curtin, which is why I've been particularly asked to come here. But I would also like to add that the period that MacArthur spent in Japan is also of great importance to us because we had been bitter enemies during the war. And yet by 1955, we entered into a commercial trade treaty with Japan, who became our leading trading partner for half a century. And we must say that surely the work that MacArthur did while he was in Japan was crucial in that process.
So he actually, in some ways, was responsible for that, for that détente.
Well, certainly he made it possible for a country like Australia, where the people bitterly hated the Japanese at the time because of the experiences of their prisoners of war and people of that kind. The MacArthur era meant that the American government was able to move decisively to an alliance with Japan, a treaty with Japan, and one which Australia accepted and which has turned out to be a great benefit to Australia ever since.
Chas, one of the things about MacArthur, and I think this is what makes him so compelling, is that his path wasn't always smooth. And when he left Korea, it was not under good circumstances. So learning about this kind of thing, I think a lot of people might not know that Australia feels this strongly about MacArthur and what he was able to do for them. How do we reconcile those parts of him today?
You mentioned struggles. His whole life was a series of struggles. He grew up on the frontier. His father was a military officer, Arthur MacArthur, general, Congressional Medal of Honor winner in the Battle of Missionary Ridge in the Civil War at age 19. So Douglas grows up in these army posts in the West, and it was pretty lean living. He goes to West Point. He gets out. He's sent to the Philippines right away. He serves there. He comes back and he serves in the First World War and receives 7 battle decorations. And then after that, comes back to the States, becomes the superintendent at West Point. And here's the next struggle. An old guard there is setting the curriculum, and he says, we've got to modernize. And he fights and he gets it. He totally modernizes West Point. Then he goes on to being chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the highest ranking person of that age, 44 in the history of the country. And again, it's the Depression. And President Roosevelt is drastically cutting the budget. And MacArthur is fighting to maintain the staff officers of the United States military in great adversity. And he had a brutal battle with Roosevelt in his office where he said, if there's an American soldier dying before they slip the bayonet into him, I want him to yell Roosevelt and curse him and not MacArthur. So he had this fiery disposition to stand up for what he thought was right. Then the Second World War comes, more adversity. He's in the Philippines. He's supposed to be resupplied. They don't resupply him. Eventually, our forces surrender there. He escapes by PT boat by order of President Roosevelt, but he's never resupplied. More adversity. They promise him the supreme commander position in Australia. He goes there, promised that they have all these forces waiting. He gets there, and there's nothing there. More adversity. So he keeps overcoming all these different things along the way. So the war goes on. Then it becomes a question of who's going to get the supplies in Australia. And President Roosevelt and Winston Churchill decided it was going to be Hitler first. We're going to defeat the Germans. More adversity. So he gets the crumbs. And thanks to an alliance with Australian Prime Minister John Curtin, the two of them together forge a relationship to turn the battle. It turns at Australia. But more adversity overcome. Then he's going up to the coast and the Philippines. He promised, I shall return. More adversity. The Allied commanders Nimitz and King meet with Roosevelt and say, we're going to go to Formosa, not the Philippines. And more. So he goes down to a meeting in Hawaii and convinces President Roosevelt, we've got to liberate the Philippines. So he overcomes that adversity. Then the war ends, and the question is, we've got people screaming to try the emperor, Hirohito, as a war criminal. And he says, no, more adversity. And he overcomes that and works as David Black said, through the Japanese government to form a new constitution that saves Japan and modifies it from a militaristic feudal society into a true democracy today. It was one adversity after another. So when he gets to Korea, he's used to the battles. He was intemperate. He was insubordinate to the president and he was removed. But he had a long, distinguished career up to that point.
Right. And it was very true to his character.
Yes.
That he continually fought for his principles and what he truly believed
right.
in and what was best for the troops under him.
Now, consider that in the middle of all of that, in I think it was 1941, during a time of great distress, his wife, Jean MacArthur, was ordered to evacuate with their 3-year-old son. And what did she say? But he and I have drank from the same cup, and I'm going to stay with him and support him. So, you know, he had adversity after adversity, but he also had someone on the home front, if you will, but on the home front with him by his side as he went around the world that was holding things together and, you know, just providing great support and courage as a base for him.
David Black, do you think that that kind of frontier upbringing and that willingness to stand for your principles, which we think of as a very American thing, is that something that resonates in Australia too?
I think it resonates probably more clearly here than it does in Australia. But what did resonate in Australia was that they saw this man who clearly was a large man physically, a large man in terms of achievements, a person who believed strongly in what he was doing and had the capacity to do it. And the fact that he was able to work so highly efficiently and harmoniously with their own prime minister, our own prime minister, who was a very different personality altogether. And it was the capacity of someone like MacArthur, and we've heard the kind of strengths of character he had, a strong, almost dominating character at times. The analogy we sometimes use in Australia that he was almost a John Wayne-like figure, the big sort of Western hero, that nevertheless he was able to work with our Prime Minister, who was a quiet, gentle man, a very effective speaker, but a very ordinary man, in fact, quite small, had quite a few difficulties in life and certainly had no significant military background, though his knowledge of military affairs was, I think, extraordinarily strong. The fact that these two men could work together is enormously important in Australian history, and it says something both about Curtin himself, but certainly about MacArthur. The fact that MacArthur was able to be dominant and forthright in the way he was, and yet at the same time so supportive of Curtin. And in Australia, if I can say, I went myself to see a memorial erected to Curtin, and they chose at the base of that memorial words from General MacArthur, in which he described Curtin as being virtually the heart and soul of Australia. So I think MacArthur showed in Australia this extraordinary capacity that, notwithstanding his other characteristics, he was able to work so harmoniously and ultimately so effectively with our Prime Minister.
So what does the legacy of Douglas MacArthur teach us today? What do you hope that this week is going to tell people who might not know any of this history?
We are very interested in the younger people in this community and throughout our country. They represent the future of America and the world. There are lessons to be learned from this. We look at the whole Far East. We had a program today on that. There are many, many threats surfacing now in the Far East with China and different disputes, territorial disputes with countries. It's a shame, but it looks like some of that history keeps repeating itself. So we want to learn from mistakes of the past. We want our young people to embrace an interest in history, become more familiar with it, come to love their history and realize that freedom is not free. It comes at a price, and that price was demonstrated by the things that General MacArthur did.
So what characteristics would you hope that young people would emulate that MacArthur had, that Jean MacArthur had?
I see Jean MacArthur as being strong, assertive, loyal, and supportive. And many times we don't learn about people in history until long after they're gone. We're talking about a local Milwaukee family here that has a local legacy. There are people in town this week that knew them personally. This isn't something from hundreds of years ago. This is recent history. You know, in Milwaukee, we have the General MacArthur statue. It's been near the courthouse, and we're moving that down. It's actually been moved now and having the unveiling this week, down to the War Memorial. And I think it's so important that when parents and children and families are down at our lakefront and they see the statue and a child says, "Mommy, who's that man?" The parent has a great opportunity now to give an answer other than, I don't know, some war guy. They can give a detailed answer and tell about General MacArthur's legacy, who he was, some of the things he did, what he stood for. And I think that this entire movement this week seeks to put not just a face to a person in history, but to breathe life back into the statue and the legacy left behind.
So just to pick up on that, the statue is now, there are 5 paths coming to a point at the Veterans Park, just right on the lakefront. He's a five-star general. There are four sides to the platform that was built. We're designing four plaques for the four sides, and we're going to pick up on what Diana said. And when those families come up and they ask the question, the parent can come over and point to the statue and look at the plaques and say, here's the story. It'll be just like the monuments in Washington, D.C.
And David, for young people in Australia, what do you hope that you're going to bring back or that they're looking at maybe via Skype or something like that while this is going on?
There are a number of different messages that one can bring back, but certainly I think it should make Australians, for a start, appreciate how fortunate they are in the world today. We are in a position where, because of the fact we're largely surrounded by sea, we have not been subject to actual land invasion. And the Japanese threat, of course, was the nearest we ever came to this. We have arguments in Australia still about people coming to Australia, arriving by boat and so on, but we do not have the hazards, the land frontiers and so on, which many other countries have. And I think Australians, to learn to appreciate that they are very, very fortunate people indeed, living a prosperous life in a relatively protected environment, but that there was one point in our history not that long ago where without the help of allies, we would have been in deep, deep trouble. And at the same time, our own leaders rose to the occasion enormously. And one of the, of course, obvious things that the war did is it developed a link between Australia and the United States of America, which is extremely strong ever since. In that period, the United States and Australia stood together against a really hostile world outside. And the people we were hostile against, we are now very close collaborators with, very much to do with the work of General MacArthur.
I want to thank all three of you for stopping in today and telling us just a little bit about General Douglas MacArthur and his Milwaukee and Australia connections. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Chas Mulcahy is the organizer of Milwaukee's MacArthur Week. Deanna Alexander is a Milwaukee County Supervisor who will speak at tomorrow's rededication of the MacArthur statue. And David Black is from Perth, Australia, and is the author of a book on MacArthur and then Australian Prime Minister John Curtin. He'll be a special guest at the ceremony. There's a link to more information at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. On this D-Day anniversary, Lake Effect foreign policy contributor Art Sear thinks there are some useful historical lessons to keep in mind.
From ancient times, amphibious military invasions are rightly regarded as particularly difficult. This is the 70th anniversary of the greatest such operation, the Allies' invasion of France in World War II on June 6, 1944, D-Day. The Normandy invasion combined thorough planning, mobilizing vast materiel, and great imagination. When the operation already underway was publicly announced, a U.S. newspaper highlighted a front-page drawing of invading soldiers cascading into Europe as a terrified Hitler fled. A year of extremely brutal, almost continuous combat lay ahead. But the end of Nazi Germany was in sight once the beaches were secured. The rule of Supreme Allied Commander General Dwight D. Eisenhower was crucial. Ike demonstrated great executive ability in supervising an unprecedented logistical challenge, and his remarkable interpersonal skills welded and held together the most diverse military alliance in history. Related to this, he was able to establish overall unity of command. This was never achieved even among the American military in the Pacific, where General Douglas MacArthur pursued one strategic vision while Navy admirals implemented a different approach. Extensive bombing of transport routes and supply depots in France was viewed by Eisenhower as crucial preparation for the land invasion. Such air action would bring an estimated minimum of 60,000 civilian casualties, and perhaps far more. For that reason, many British and American air commanders resisted this widespread destruction, arguing for a much more limited effort. Eisenhower was adamant about the absolute need for extensive bombing, arguing that less would put the invasion at severe risk. He was able to turn to the leader of the Free French, General Charles de Gaulle, whose nation was the target. De Gaulle agreed completely and gave unequivocal support. Uniquely among senior Allied commanders, Ike had managed to establish an effective working relationship with the demanding, difficult French leader. Simultaneously, the American leader never lost awareness of the terrible human costs of war, borne primarily by the enlisted ranks. He constantly stressed the fundamentally important role of the combat soldier and regularly went to see troops in the field. This dimension is captured especially by classic photographs of his visit with young American paratroopers preparing to depart to initiate D-Day. Ike had the gift of imagination. During heavy fighting for Sicily in 1943, General George S. Patton, Jr. slapped two U.S. soldiers suffering extreme combat stress. And in the ensuing intense public maelstrom, he was almost fired. In reaction, Nazi leaders dismissed the controversy as fabricated propaganda. The German military annually routinely executed thousands of their own men for various infractions. Eisenhower responded by isolating Patton in England, where an entirely fictitious army was created around him. Actors were assigned roles, bogus information generated, phony structures constructed of cheap materials. The great trick worked. On D-Day and immediately thereafter, crucial German units were held back, in part because Patton's fictitious forces had not yet moved. Carthage College teachers over the years have made good use of the ancient classic The Art of War by Chinese philosopher Sun Tzu, who stressed the importance of deception. Ike may or may not have read the book. He could have written the volume easily. When Eisenhower died, newly inaugurated President Richard M. Nixon's insightful eulogy compared him to George Washington, quote, first in war, first in peace, and first in the hearts of his countrymen, unquote. On this anniversary, Ike provides enduring lessons for all of us.
Art Sear is Clausen Distinguished Professor of Political Economy at Carthage College in Kenosha, and he is a Lake Effect contributor. A Milwaukee Historical Museum marks D-Day with a special exhibit, and we'll learn about it next when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Bonnie North. D-Day is one of the most recognizable moments in World War II history, but a new exhibit opening today in Milwaukee, in time to commemorate the 70th anniversary of that invasion, is focusing on some of the lesser-known individual moments of valor. The Chudnow Museum of Yesteryear is featuring a special exhibit of a Milwaukee man's unique collection of World War II artifacts. Collector Vim Leidis hopes the pieces he's gathered will help tell the story of Jewish soldiers and the Jewish partisans who fought against the Nazis. Leidis joined Chudnow Executive Director Steve Daly at the museum, and Daly began by telling Lake Effect's Stephanie Lecce more about some of the pieces of Leidis' collection.
Well, he's got some original uniforms, some weapons, some headgear, like I said, various letters, diaries, photographs. It's quite a range of products and ideas and things here that show that experience in World War II. If we're talking about the partisans, he actually has a day-to-day diary that a partisan kept while he was fighting in Eastern Europe. He's got letters and other documents and photos related to a woman partisan who's still alive. She's 93 years old and lives in Toronto, and he's been in correspondence with her. And so he's kind of got her life story laid out for us in photos and some of her text, some letters from some other partisans of what their experiences were like in the war. And luckily, Milwaukee has a Jewish fighter from the Jewish Brigade in World War II that's still alive, and he's coming to our event here on Friday night. We're going to have a lecture, so he's going to be talking about his experiences fighting under the British, but as part of this Jewish Brigade.
Well, tell us a little bit more about this Jewish Brigade. It's kind of one of those footnotes of history that people don't often know that much about.
Yeah, it was a group of Jewish soldiers and citizens when Poland was overrun by the Germans in World War II. This group made an effort to become part of somebody's army, and the British Army took them in and allowed them to remain all together as part of a separate unit called the Jewish Brigade. And so they trained specifically to fight together as one unit, and they did participate in a couple of battles in World War II. Unfortunately, it was near the end of the war, but at least they got a chance to fight back and show the world that they fought back and tried to make a difference.
Vim, tell us about why it was important to you to collect all of these artifacts and bring the stories of the Jewish Brigade to light.
I actually started as somebody who was just interested in the Holocaust, when I was a lot younger. And from there on, it just kind of grew, Like the last 5 to 10 years, I would say, it really started going for me in a direction where, I've been focusing on the Holocaust for such a long time that I actually started, asking myself questions like, well, what happened to a lot of these survivors, or what happened after that? And so actually that led me to hear a lot of the other stories other than the Holocaust stories of where Jewish resistance and how these people survived, And I started learning about the Jewish Brigade and about the Haganah, the Irgun, and the whole formation of the State of Israel, and even up to current affairs, which is what I'm been studying. And one of the aspects that I came across was, not only people that survived and how the rest of their lives looked, but also things that were going on during the Holocaust, as in Jewish resistance, And it's an often overlooked thing, and actually a lot of the testimonies that I've read or have seen in, in videos where they give their own testimonies, one occurring thing that I found was that there's this myth that people think that people were just led to the slaughter like sheep, that there was no resistance and the people just let themselves take away and be killed, And the more I start researching it, it's like so absolutely not true, And one thing that I hope that people will get from this exhibit too is that if they learn anything from this, I want them to learn that not only did the Jewish people resist, but they actively fought back and they were actually very successful at it, And that's something that I said that's a recurring theme in their testimonies, that they always keep saying that, we want the people to know that we did fight back, the Jewish people did fight back. It's not only the things that people or some people might just know a little bit of, like, the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising is one of the more famous ones where most people that are familiar with World War II might have heard of, but there's so many other forms of resistance that is just often overlooked, and one of them is the Jewish Brigade, another one are the Jewish partisans, and there was so much resistance in the camps too, where they blew up the crematorias, they broke out of the camps, and so yeah, that's what, what got me into all this. And I'm always very interested and very connected to the personal stories, how people survived, how they experienced it, and how they got the strength to keep going, And even though a lot of people, like the partisan stuff, like their entire families were murdered, and it's just so easy to give up, but, they kept fighting, and it's just so admirable.
Among the artifacts that you have here are a series of photographs. My eye just can't help but be drawn to them, of a woman in a leopard print coat, right, and a gun. She's a member of the Jewish partisans. Can you tell us her story?
Okay, well, the lady you're talking about is Faye Schumann, Faye Lazepnik Schumann. She's got an incredible story, and the reason why there's a couple of her photos on here and why I made a little frame here too, kind of telling her story, is because she's one of the partisans that I really deeply connect to. She's actually still alive today. She's 92 years old. She lives in Toronto right now, and I'm planning on visiting her in October this year. I've talked to her like about 5 or 6 times on the phone now. But anyway, her story, she was, she could have been very easily one of the many numbers of statistics from all these towns that were leveled by the Germans, where entire communities were wiped out, and the Germans came to her town, and within no time, they rounded up the whole town, and they were shot at mass graves. They had like pits in the forest, and they made the people line up, strip naked, and they were just shot, And there's so many towns that were killed that way, and her town was exactly like that. But what saved her at that point was she had learned photography from her brother. Her brother was a photographer, and the Germans knew about that because the time that they were in the town and before they killed the town, they knew about her photography, and they already had used her skills to, they made her photograph some of these murderers, and some of these Nazis. And when they rounded up the people, they picked her out of line and with her 5 other families, and they boarded these people up in synagogue. And she was actually able to see out of the windows of the synagogue what was going on. And she saw how the whole town, and including her own family, was taken away on trucks. And, at that point, not knowing what happened, but later she found out what happened. And the only reason why they saved her and these other 5 families was because the Germans thought they could use their trades a little bit longer before taking them away as well. And, a lot of these SS guys, they thought they wanted to have portraits of themselves, and they gave her negatives of photos that they took. And one of those photos was from those mass graves where they killed up her town. And actually, she recognized her own parents in one of his graves, which was really, you know, a bizarre thing. And she actually saved that negative for herself too, as evidence if she might survive, that she has evidence what took place there. She thought about escaping, but as other reprisals that the Germans did, if one escaped, they would kill the rest, you know. So she knew that if she would escape, they would kill the other families, and she didn't want to do that. So about 10 days into it, there was a raid from the partisans on that town, because the partisans were aware that the whole town was wiped out and that the Germans were, you know, took over everything that was there, and the partisans wanted to attack the Germans. They did, and in the midst of the chaos, she was able to escape. She went to the forest and was hoping to join the partisans, and, you know, a lot of the partisans weren't really excited to take women on board, you know. But then one of the people in the partisans knew that one of her family members was a doctor, so they assumed that she could be a doctor or a medic in their unit, so they accepted her. And she spent the next 3.5 to 4 years with the partisans in the forest. She's the only partisan that was actually able to photograph a lot of the partisan activity during the time in the partisans.
Well, Steve, let me ask, how does a story like Faye's fit into not only this exhibit, but the broader mission of the Chudnow Museum? A lot of this happened after the time period, or just at the tail end of the time period that the Chudnow really tries to document. So why was it important to include this material here at the museum?
Partly because Mr. Chudnow was a veteran of World War II, and he did serve in D-Day. He landed on Omaha Beach on the second day, and he was part of the port battalion that unloaded all the supplies for the GIs landing on the shores of France. So we felt it was a way to honor his service during World War II. And I just thought with the 70th anniversary of D-Day that we had to do something, not necessarily related to Mr. Chudnow, but just something in general about World War II to show the great sacrifices and things that went on in that era. Since Mr. Chudnow was Jewish, this is a way for us to tell another part of the Jewish story. And so it's a way for the museum to talk about how one individual can change history. We feel that Mr. Chudnow's collection, his vast number of things that he saved, is a perfect example how one person can make such a difference. Well, Faye is another one of those people that one person can make a difference. So I think this exhibit kind of typifies what I think the whole educational experience about our museum is.
Well, Steve Daly and Vim Leitis, thank you both so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Stephanie.
Steve Daly is the executive director of the Chudnow Museum of Yesteryear, where a new World War II exhibit on the Jewish Brigade and Jewish Partisans opens today. The exhibit is based on the collection of Milwaukeean Vim Leitis, who's also the author of My Jewish Journey. He'll be giving a lecture on his collection this evening and next Thursday. The Chudnow will also present World War II reenactors tomorrow morning and host a talk by Milwaukee World War II veteran and author Eugene Schultz on June 10th. Daly and Leitis spoke with Stephanie Lecce. The new Bucks owners came to town recently, and our sports contributor reviews their visit next on Lake Effect. You are listening to us on WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks for joining us. The NBA Finals are underway, and not surprisingly, they don't involve the Milwaukee Bucks. But there's still some buzz about basketball around town. The Bucks will have the second pick in the upcoming NBA draft, and the team's new owners have made a big effort to connect with the city's fan base. Howie Magner is our regular sports contributor, and he talked with Mitch Teich about the owners' Get to Know Us tour of Milwaukee last week.
I thought they did a really good job of coming across as regular guys, for as much as a couple of billionaires can come across as regular guys.
Right, they started at a donut shop in my neck of the woods.
I mean, look, I'm sure there was some grand PR theme behind it. It's not like they just got out of the cars and started walking around the city. They had a plan of what they were going to do, and they went to these very specific places. And they were in for 2 days. Thursday, they started at a donut shop, and they wandered around there and talked to folks. They ended up at the Bucks Practice Center to watch some of the draft prospects work out, and they met the media scrum there and talked for a fair amount of time. They took all questions and in a, you know, your typical press conference setting, and then they broke off and did some one-on-one interviews after that.
And for the most part, they were very forthcoming with their answers, and they, you know, put a nice banter. I mean, they actually liked to joke, or certainly seemed like they liked to joke with the media guys. And then the big event for them was that evening. After they did say, before we get to the evening, they said they were going to go chat with Senator Cole and just to catch up on things. And then that evening, they were going to go watch a basketball game with fans at a bar, McGillicuddy's on Water Street. And I didn't get out there, but Dan Schaefer of the magazine, Milwaukee Magazine, got out there and said it was quite the party atmosphere. They were interacting with fans. They were signing autographs. They were answering fans' questions about the draft. They seemed very, very comfortable, not just with Milwaukee and Milwaukee fans, but with selling their vision of the Bucks to those people.
What difference does it make, the kind of rapport that owners have with the fans?
I think if an owner of a team can build a rapport with a fan base, and it's very difficult to do, then it has some benefits. It builds trust with the fan base. It gives the fan base the impression that their team is in good hands, and maybe they're willing to take extra steps with one particular ownership group versus another particular ownership group. Are they more willing to buy tickets from that guy? Are they more willing to get on board and become advocates for a downtown arena for these new guys than more so than they perhaps would have been with Senator Cole?
Presumably, this can't be a one-shot deal, though. They can't just go to a bar one night and expect it to change.
The real key with it, I think, is that it comes across as genuine, that it doesn't have a PR flavor or feel to it. Even though it is PR, it's got to feel genuine. Better than that, it's got to be genuine. And I think the way you do that is by, you know, building it up over time. Don't just do this stuff on a one-off basis. Don't just show up and then head off to New York for 3 years. The key is they have to keep coming back and keep interacting with the community and keep sharing their vision for what this team will be and why they believe that the downtown arena is not only good for them but good for the city as a whole, good for the citizens of that city, good for Marquette University, or good for music goers, good for everybody involved. And if they can continue to do that and continue to build disciples, if you will, then I think it increases their chances of fulfilling their long-term vision, which, as stated, is to build a new arena downtown and to build a championship-caliber team in the Bucks.
Okay, so let's talk about building the championship-caliber team in the Bucks. They are not the talent scouts here, but what is their role as far vis-a-vis the draft goes? They have the wallets.
Yep. What they have said, and they said this throughout their tour last week, was that they are going to rely on the current basketball people in the front office, John Hammond, David Morey, those guys, to give them all the information on the draft and to give them all their input and opinion on the draft. And then in the end, it will be something of a collaborative effort between the Basketball Brain Trust and the ownership group. I got the feeling that Lazary and Edens were going to have some input on this, and in the end, it might be their decision. They may take all this information that Hammond and his crew puts together, and if Hammond gives him a recommendation on player A and Lazary and Edens believe, despite all that, they want to take player B, it's going to be player B. I think they made that pretty clear. And look, it's their right. They're the guys that invested all this money in this team, and even though you hire these people to give you their best basketball opinion, it's your team, and you're going to do with it what you want. And if they want player B, then that's who it's going to be.
How much difference can player A or player B make immediately to this team?
Well, if you listen to the basketball experts out there, they will make more of an impact this year than they would in most years. It's a very top-heavy draft class when it comes to talent. And the players that you hear talked about with the top four selections are Joel Embiid, the 7-foot center out of Kansas, Andrew Wiggins, the out of Kansas, who's they were teammates. They got along pretty well. Jabari Parker, worker out of Duke. And then Dante Exum, who's a point guard out of Australia that a lot of people in America might not necessarily know about unless you're a bit of a basketball geek as far as stats and international video, things like that go. The general consensus now is that Embiid's going to go first, either to the Cavs or to somebody who trades to get that pick from the Cavs, and that the Bucks will be left to pick between Wiggins and Parker. The general thought is that Parker's a bit better scorer right now. He's an NBA-level scorer at this point. Wiggins appears to have better upside than Parker. He's more athletic. He's a better defender. But there are questions about his work ethic. So Wiggins could end up being a bigger player for you if he's willing to commit himself to that. Parker can probably have more of an immediate impact. With the Bucks, I don't know that they necessarily have to have a championship caliber come in, a championship caliber player come in on day one. This is a long-term rebuilding project. It's not just going to be Parker or Wiggins who carries this team. It's going to be Giannis Antetokounmpo and Brandon Knight and maybe John Henson and maybe Larry Sanders and maybe the guy they pick in next year's draft and the draft after that, and then maybe some free agents down the road.
Nowhere to go but up for the Bucks.
Well, that's certainly the case when you have the worst record in franchise history.
Well, on the flip side, right now, still nowhere to go but down for the Brewers because they are consistently sitting at the top of the National League Central. Some ups and downs, but still more ups than downs.
Yeah, they've basically been the division leader for about a month and a half, right now it's a significant gap for the beginning of June. You know, they're kind of hovering between 4 and 5 games ahead of the St. Louis Cardinals, and then you got to go back a few more games before you get to the Reds and the Pirates. Now, look, nobody's going to give you a prize for leading the division in June, but it certainly is a good sign for the Brewers because everybody believes that the NL Central has been one of the better divisions in baseball recently, and the Brewers are clearly the best of that class. Look, their formula has been pretty simple, really, when you get down to it. It's been really good starting pitching, a bullpen that started out as the best in baseball and has struggled a little bit more than that, but they were so good that you knew they were going to come back down to earth, but it's still a good bullpen. And they had been getting enough offense, and then they got great offense for a stretch of about 10 days. And you have to believe the offense is going to continue to get better because Aramis Ramirez is back and healthy now. They held that lead all throughout the month of May despite really being hit hard by injuries, not just to Aramis Ramirez, but also to Ryan Braun and to Carlos Gomez. So those are basically their three best hitters.
Well, and so at the beginning of the year, when you looked at who the players were that were going to be the offensive leaders, you figured Ryan Braun, you figured Aramis Ramirez, you figured Carlos Gomez. Probably you didn't necessarily figure that the guy that was going to lead you in power was Mark Reynolds.
Well,
I mean, the guy could hit, but
yeah,
he was a big question mark.
Well, I think the problem was is you weren't really sure what his consistency level was going to be from a week-to-week basis. Mark Reynolds historically has been a guy who's going to hit you 30, 35 home runs, and he's also going to strike out about 200 times, and he's going to give you a batting average anywhere between 250 and 200. That type of player can be frustrating sometimes because he can go through a big dry spell and then he can win you 3 games in a row with his bat. That's not necessarily a bad thing. You just have to be prepared for that. And where it really came in handy was when Aramis Ramirez went on the disabled list, and then you could shift Mark Reynolds over to third base where he's not only hit some home runs, and as you said, he's leading the team in home runs, but he's also played really good defense. Now, is he the best option at first base for a championship contender team once Aramis Ramirez is healthy again? That's another debate. You know, there are certainly better players out there. But look, Mark Reynolds, you didn't bring him in to be the best hitter on the team. You brought him in to be a contributing hitter on the team. And I think he has certainly given the Brewers what they expected when they signed him.
And he certainly is producing more than certainly the first base position did last year.
Oh, yeah. Well, you and I might have been able to do that. Maybe not quite, but we would have gotten close. But look, I don't know if the exact numbers if you take the platoon between Reynolds and Overbay, but they've certainly been pretty close to an average first baseman. And last year, the Brewers basically had the worst first base production in all of baseball. So, yeah, it's a big change.
Howie, always nice to throw them in the dirt and have you scoop them up.
Thank you, Mitch Tyke. It's always a pleasure to do it for you.
Have a good weekend.
All right, take care.
Howie Magner is Lake Effect's regular sports contributor. He writes the Sports Nut column for Milwaukee Magazine's website, and he's senior editor of the magazine. He spoke with Mitch Tyke. Howie's colleague Claire Hannon shares the story of the magazine's summer drinking guide next when Lake Effect returns. You're listening to us on WUWM. Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Each summer, Milwaukee Magazine compiles its list of what's what in town. The City Guide issue serves as an introduction for newcomers and an eye-opener for old-timers as well. Among this year's offerings is a guide for the best places for a refreshing and alcoholic drink this summer. Assistant editor Claire Hannon compiled the piece, and she tells Lake Effect's Stephanie Lecce more about the project.
Every few years, we put out a best bars guide. And then in 2012, we did a guide to all things beer. So those are kind of our base, and we wanted to approach this differently and in a fresh way. The easiest way to do that was to put it in our City Guide issue. So the logic was that you could use this all summer long as kind of your guide to where should we go on a Saturday night, while also not repeating everything in those previous issues. So we wanted to focus on the newer bars that also had really good patios and views and all that. So while Pedal Tavern certainly didn't make the last one, I don't think, but also places like the Jackson's Blue Ribbon Pub. I don't think we had Stubby's in the last one, and their patio deck thing is amazing. Ugly's Pub was not, but just to get in all of those places, Ruby Tap, that have great patios, great outdoor atmospheres that are just as good, if not better, as indoors.
What makes Milwaukee's outdoor drinking scene unique compared with other cities?
Well, I think in a couple ways, the beer gardens are becoming, or have become, but probably will become even bigger as they open more of them. I just saw the Beer Garden on Wheels open yesterday. But these beer gardens are becoming huge. And also, I think Milwaukeeans have a special appreciation for outdoor drinking venues because, especially this year, we were stuck inside for 7 months straight, it felt like. So I think if it's a beautiful day and there's an outdoor opportunity, tons of people are going to take it.
Where were some of the best places to get your drink and a view?
Well, it depends on what you want to drink, but we thought that the Yard, of course, is great. They've got an awesome cocktail.
Which, describe this location. I didn't know about the Yard.
Oh, yeah. It's adjacent to the Iron Horse Hotel, and it's by the Harley Museum, kind of in an industrial area, but it's this really, it's kind of like an oasis in this very industrial area. Jackson's Blue Ribbon Pub downtown, another really cool area because it's kind of in this ghost town of the old Pabst breweries and the brewery buildings, which are all but abandoned. And you're just kind of sitting there in the middle of it all, these really cool old historic buildings in a huge patio setting. Stubby's is one of my personal favorites because it's overlooking the river. So you've got a really good breeze going on, a cool view of the city, and their Stubby's has a fantastic beer list.
What are some of the summer cocktails we should be sure to sample this summer?
Well, the guys at Hotel Foster and Boone and Crockett can do fantastic things with cocktails. They can riff on things like the Tom Collins. I think one of their bartenders told us anything on ice with bubbles and gin will work all summer. So all of those things, I mean, there are some great local cocktails.
Speaking of local cocktails, there's a little vignette in this package. It features what they do at Bryant's. Can you tell us a little bit about what's special about the approach to making cocktails at Bryant's?
Sure. Well, we couldn't write a bar story without including Bryant's. They're one of the best bars in town and certainly one of the most creative, if not the most creative. And what they do is they don't really have a standard menu. You just tell the bartender how you feel, and they come up with a drink based on whatever you tell them. So we thought, well, how are we going to cover this in a new way? We've written about this a billion times. We decided, let's throw really odd, maybe uncomfortable emotions at them and just see what they make us. So our managing editor, Tim, took his wife, and they threw some really weird emotions at the Bryant's guys.
Right, like, I'm feeling like I'm at the bottom of the diaper bin.
Yeah, right. When we were brainstorming the ideas to give the Bryant's people, they got really, you know, I feel like I might murder someone. They were really odd. But Bryant's, they came up with some awesome drinks.
Were there any establishments that came up as you compiled this list that really surprised you?
I don't know if any of them really surprised me. I think I was more surprised by how many there were that we were all like, yes, yes, them too, them too. So I think it was more just the volume surprised me than any specific place.
How do you hope readers are going to use this? I mean, do you imagine readers are going to do a Milwaukee Magazine cocktail crawl or something like that?
I would suggest getting a cab or an Uber driver if you're going to do that. But I just hope they read it, they look back to it all summer and kind of say, oh, yeah, I've been, you know, wanting to try that drink at Lucky Joe's Tiki Room, or I'm going to look at this guide for one of the World Cup bars once those games start in the next couple weeks, or keep the beer garden story around. I've gotten some really good feedback on kind of looking at the then and now of Milwaukee's beer gardens, which a lot of people don't realize they used to be all indoors.
I didn't know that. They also were extremely family friendly. I guess I didn't really understand that previously. They were a social environment for families to go to.
Yeah, and I think we said the retail locations are what kind of eventually did them in, because the breweries themselves didn't have to host these places for people to try their beers. But yeah, we've got a picture of this Schlitz Palm Garden, which was this beautiful, like, conical venue almost with palm trees and all this great wood paneling. Looks very different from the Landing at Hoyt or Estabrook's beer garden.
What do you think these modern incarnations of beer gardens are going for? And is it different from the original mission of beer gardens?
I don't think so. I think it's very true to the original idea, which was just a great place to bring your family and meet your friends and celebrate a Milwaukee pastime. I think currently they're just outdoors, which maybe might make them a little more accessible and approachable, but I think it's still the same idea.
Well, Claire Hannon, thank you so much for coming in and giving us a little preview of the guide to summer drinking.
Thanks for having me.
Claire Hannon is assistant editor at Milwaukee Magazine. She spoke with Stephanie Lecce. The Indispensable Summer Drinking Guide is in the current issue, which is the magazine's city guide. And that's all for the Friday edition of Lake Effect, with thanks to our production team of Mitch Tyke, Stephanie Lecce, and Dan Harmon. We get production assistance from Eleanor Peterson, web support from Michelle Maternowski, and studio engineering from John Strelecki. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you enjoy a libation of your choice this weekend. We're here tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend, and of course back here at 10 on Monday morning for the next edition of Lake Effect. It's all on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.